is the Late Night Insomniac. Pizza injecting straight into my eye. No government man, Michael Dean, the Iron Hamster, the Freedom Fiend. We got another Freedom Fiend on this line. We have Chandler St. Pierre. Hello, Chandler.
Evening.
And you are the Jabbering Coon Cat. Is that it?
Yeah, I am.
That's almost racist. I don't even know what that means. Talking about Maine Coons, right?
Maine Coons.
I have a Maine Coon or two.
Yeah, they're
Fuzzy.
Awesome.
Fuzzy's a Maine Coon. They are just bizarre domestic beasts that want to eat your arm off, but they're not big enough.
Yeah. They're cool cats.
So we were starting our show prep, and I want to review... I think you want to review a book I haven't read, and I want to review a movie you haven't seen. Have you seen Sound City?
No, but I plan to check it out.
Okay, it's got your boy Trent Reznor in it.
Then I definitely plan to check
it out. I know that you get a soft, gushy spot somewhere on your body whenever he's talking or rocking.
Yep.
All right, wake up, man, wake up. I know that you don't have a compressor, and you didn't have enough coffee yet. And I should never, here's some teaching hospital. You should never point out on air if someone's sounding sleepy or not. But let's get you going. Let's wake you up. Tell me about this book I haven't read. What's it called? Why should I care?
Well, it's called The Alchemist.
By whom?
And Paolo, I can't even pronounce his last name.
Spell it.
It is, let me see here. C-O... I can't even find it.
Time's
anymore.
Up.
Yeah. Anyway, it's The Alchemist. And if people Google it, they can find it pretty easy. And it's a great book. It's got the hero's journey in it. And it's kind of a coming of age story. And they use the allegory of turning lead into gold. But the story is all about a boy seeking his treasure. And the treasure is, you know, monetary wealth. But in the journey of seeking his treasure, he finds true treasure, which is the people he meets along the way.
That's let me interject there for those people taking the Michael Dean storytelling course at home. That's a red herring. Now, we usually think of red herrings in the terms of bad arguments that statists give us. You know, like that's a logical fallacy. But a red herring is also a storytelling technique, and it's pretty common with the hero's journey. It's pretty common also in police procedurals, like, red herring. Okay. The idea of a red herring is supposedly they used to train scent dogs. They'd say, here's the rabbit, go find the rabbit. And then while training them to get them even better, they would drag a dead fish, fresh dead fish across the path vertically to try to confuse it. You know, the red herring. It's something that tries to make you run off in the other direction. And it's really common in storytelling, and it's kind of useful. A really common example is in like almost every CSI has a red herring. Like, there's a child who's been molested, and, you know, the next door neighbor is a registered sex offender who served time in prison for molesting children.
Yeah, you see that in a lot of
He's the red herring. You're like, of course he did it. And then you find out he didn't. Yeah. And a lot of times with the hero's journey, the apparent goal of the hero in the first act is not the goal of what he found in the third act.
Yeah, well, one of the things I really liked about the book was at the end of the book, he ends up right where he started off. But in a much better, like in the physical location, but in a much better place. And then it leaves it open for him to pursue, now that he's fulfilled his dream, to pursue even more. And the whole moral of the story is that you can settle on, you know, get caught up in life and, you know, make a living and just settle for whatever comes your way. Or you can follow your dream. And it talks about how most of us just end up settling and never really following our dreams, and how rewarding it can be if you actually do put in the effort and do the hard thing sometimes. It was just a really great book, and it's a really easy read. I read it in like 3 hours.
It looks like a children's book almost, the cover of it. Is it?
It's not, but like I said,
young adults book.
I guess it's written in that sort of style. But there's some pretty deep themes in it, you know.
Does it follow a young Andalusian shepherd named Santiago in his journey to Egypt?
Yeah.
After a recurring dream of finding treasure there?
Yeah. The book review, when I read it, when I read the review, I was like, that does sound kind of young adultish. But it's good. I would suggest everyone read it. It's just one of those inspiring things.
Yeah, it was originally written in Portuguese. Does it have any kind of Chinglish-y feel of like, does it have a feel of having been written in another language, either in a good way or a bad way?
Not at all.
Yeah, because sometimes things don't translate well, and sometimes it's got to do with the translator, sometimes it doesn't. And sometimes things are even better in the translation. I've heard that one of the reasons that Hubert Selby's books were much more popular in Europe than in America is because the things that his editor made him kind of like squash down in the English versions of them, some of the editors like took poetic license with and like saw where he was going and brought it back in the French or German or Spanish translations. Where'd you go, man?
That made sense. Yeah. I'm telling you, it's so hard not having a knob on a mixer to turn when you need to mute the microphone.
I have hundreds of knobs. I could lend you one of mine.
Oh, that'll work.
You know, speaking of translations, this book, this novel, The Alchemist, is the most translated book by a living author. It's translated into 56 different languages, and it's a bestseller too. It sold 65 million copies.
Yeah, I'm really not surprised after reading it.
Yeah.
It's like I said, it's not very time consuming. I'm not a super fast reader, but I said I went out in my backyard Sunday and sat down, had a drink, and just started reading. And I was, I don't know, after an hour or so, I was halfway through the book, and it was getting late, so I turned in, and I just got up the next day and finished.
There's also an audiobook of it.
It was really well worth the read.
There's an audiobook of it on iTunes. This is kind of interesting. Did you know this, that the author, Paulo Coelho, C-O-E-L-H-O, is a strong advocate of file sharing, and he put his own books on BitTorrent?
I didn't know that, but I think that's great.
We like him even more now.
He obviously gets it. He wants to get out there.
Mm-hmm. And he said it actually helped sales of the book. Giving it away helped for sales. And audio versions of it, you can still get audio versions of it free on his blog.
Well, I got the electronic version for my Kindle for free.
The ebook? So, the ebook?
The ebook, a Mobi format. So that's another thing, too. I've had this discussion with a lot of people. Kindles versus regular books. And so many of my friends are like, oh, I just can't do the Kindle. You know, it's not the feel of a real book. And I get that. And there are definitely some books, like I've been reading a lot of Charles Bukowski, like I told you last time, and his poetry books. I like to have physical copies of that so I can just flip through them at any time. But a lot of the novels I've read, I got to tell you, it's great having them on a Kindle. You know, you can have thousands of books at your fingertips.
Yeah. I got my wife a Kindle for Christmas, and she loves it. She is a heroic consumer of books. I mean, we have over 1,000 books on a bookshelf in the house, and that's the books she's purchased since I met her. Because most of the books that we had, actually, I think it's the books mostly we've purchased since we moved to Wyoming 5 years ago. Because when I met her, she had a bunch of books, and when we moved, she gave a lot of them away to some local charity to sell, you know, Goodwill or something. And yeah, she loves them and she rereads books. But and she was really against getting a Kindle for a long time. And we went into a stationery store one day and she picked one up and started playing with it. And she's like, you know, I don't think I hate this as much as I thought I would. And she loves it.
Before I moved and bought my house, I had a lot of books on bookshelves, and I don't have any room here anymore, so I don't have most of my books are packed. And I was never like that with Kindles. I've always embraced technology. I'm a big tech guy, and I love it. And like I said, it's so great because during my daily course of life and everything, if I just carry my Kindle with me. And I usually tend to stick to one book at a time, but once in a while, depending on what I'll read. Like right now, I'm reading a couple of different Hunter S. Thompson books. And I took your advice and I read Post Office. It was pretty good.
It's pretty funny.
Yeah. It was basically the precursor to Women, which I still can't get myself to finish that book.
You're talking Bukowski books here, for those who don't know.
It's just a train wreck.
It's a train wreck that's fun to watch.
Rum Diaries. And I got to say, as with is so often the case, I finished The Rum Diary, and I had seen the movie when it first came out. And it was a few years ago, and I popped it in the other night to watch it over, and I couldn't even make it through it because so much of it was changed from the book, and I was just like, nah, nope.
That's a big problem that a lot of people have with adaptations. I actually kind of like the movie adaptation. It kind of plays on that. You ever seen that?
What movie?
The movie called Adaptation.
No, I haven't. I'll have to check that out.
Really? You never seen Adaptation?
Not that I'm aware of. Who's in it?
Nicolas Cage plays two different people who are twin brothers.
Yeah, I remember you talking about that.
Yeah, it's basically a movie that it's a meta movie in that you're aware that the person in the movie the main character is the screenwriter of the movie. You know, it's one of those, but it's not cheesy. It's done really well. And it makes fun of the hero's journey while embracing the hero's journey. I mean, to the point where at one point the screenwriter has writer's block and he goes to a screenwriting seminar that's an actual screenwriting seminar that's taught every weekend in LA and costs, you know, $1,000 a weekend for each person, and it's always packed.
Cool.
Yeah. Check out Adaptation. Spike Jonze, man.
Definitely check that out.
Yep. We'll be back on Freedom Fiends. Screenwriting classes. Distance learning, screenwriting, anarchy lessons.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and his weird friends, tasing you with liberty since 2011. Learn more at freedomfiends.com.
Hey, this is Nathan Explosion from Death Clock, and you're listening to Freedom Fiends on the radio. Worms.
Greetings, kitty cats and wild beasts. It's Michael Dean emulating into your synapses over vibrating ether. I think that's what radio is.
That sounds kind of sexy. Emulating.
I don't know if I used that verb correctly, but I like it the way I used it. Emulating into your synapses. It kind of sounds like some form of tesseraction or moving something from one place to another without really moving there, just being there.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Like the transporter in Star Trek. Or the
speaking of which,
or the tesseract in A Wrinkle in Time. What? Go ahead.
When are we getting transporters? I've been waiting years for that growing up as a Star Trek fan.
They went the same places that flying cars. Yeah, all the money was spent on drones. Yeah. All the money was sucked out of our pockets and put into the drone program.
That's square.
I don't know. There've been some quantum computing breakthroughs lately that, you know, the kind of breakthroughs that with transporting things that, you know, the kind of stuff that only nerds with four PhDs really can see as a breakthrough.
Yeah.
But later will, be really useful to us. Kind of like how, you know, when we're sitting in math class in high school saying, how's this going to help me in later life? You know, once it got past adding, subtracting, multiplying, and dividing, when it got into algebra and geometry and calculus. And you know that kid that was sitting in front of you, like eating it all up and doing really well in it?
Yeah.
That's the kid that designed MP3s.
That he's awesome.
Yeah.
Did you hear about the computer that just passed the Turing test in the landmark trial?
Yeah, I don't really know why that's such a big deal. I mean, passing the Turing test, did it pass it universally with every person that tried it? Because it's kind of subjective.
Yeah, the couple of articles I read didn't really go into that. And I know it was, I guess most of the people couldn't tell if it was a computer or a real guy. So
I mean, there's a program, I think it's called ELIZA, that was made for mainframe computers in the 70s. I think you can download an emulator of it, too. It's a text-based program, and it comes pretty close to tricking people in the Turing test. It's basically a virtual therapist. Like, you ask it something, it asks you something back, and you can go back and forth for about 20 or 30 before it trips up, and you're absolutely convinced it's not a person.
Yeah, it's definitely not AI, like on the level of Terminator or anything. Apparently, the article I'm looking at right now, the program managed to convince 33% of the judges that it was human. So I guess that's really not all that high.
Yeah, ELIZA is, you know, really old school and ran on really slow computers and could probably do better than that.
Yeah. So anyway, we were going to go to House of Cards.
The American TV show from Netflix.
Yes. And I took your advice and I started watching it. And I was hooked. I burned through the first season, I think, in about a week. I don't watch a whole lot of TV. But and they're long, too. You know, they're about 56 minutes long each. No commercials, which I love. That's one of the beautiful things about Netflix original series. And I haven't got all the way through season two, but when I saw the first episode of season two, my jaw literally dropped.
Okay, we got some spoiler alerts here, but I would say I'm kind of the belief that there aren't really spoiler alerts with things that have been out for a year that all the episodes are up.
Yeah, especially the way they release those all at once.
Which I love.
Yes, me too. And so when Francis basically throws Zoe, the reporter, in front of a train, it happens so suddenly. And at that moment, I realized, okay, this guy has gone from sociopathic to complete psychopathic. You know, you don't even see it coming. He's like, oh my God, when she says that, you know, I want to make sure that you're not part of this murder. And he kind of sighs and walks off, and she follows him to try to convince him, and he just turns around and throws her right in front of the train. Very graphic for TV.
Yeah, I got to say, Sean Duvalli said that, our torrent master said that to me when he saw it, and I was like 8 episodes ahead of him, and my response was, dude, that's like the least shocking thing that happens in season two. You just wait.
Yeah, so I've been told as well.
So I'm on ELIZA, the bot, the emulator, and I typed yo, and it said, don't you ever say hello.
That's awesome.
We should play with this when we come back.
All right.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends. Go to freedomfiends.com to help keep it drone-proof.
When you shop online, please do it through the Freedom Fiends Amazon link over on the right side of freedomfiends.com. It won't cost you any extra, and the fiends will get a little taste from Amazon, and Amazon will save you the danger of drive-by stabbings at your local mall. Amazon sells pretty much everything you can buy on this earth, except for guns and weed. But they do sell the DVD Guns and Weed, The Road to Freedom. So get that for your gun-hating stoner brother or neocon gun nut dad. They'll thank you for it. That's freedomfiends.com. Freedom, Foxtrot, Echo, Echo, November, Sierra.com.
This is the Freedom Fiends, failing the Turing test since 2011. So you want to talk about House of Cards, the TV show?
Yeah, I guess the biggest thing I wanted to say is, especially to people who haven't seen the show, it's really good to watch because it illustrates just how dishonest and disingenuous the whole political system is. You see how Frank and his, disingenuous the whole political system is.
Well, you know, Barack Obama has been quoted as saying that he wished there were more congressmen like Frank Underwood.
Well, I can see why he would say that.
Yeah, because he gets things done by murdering people. By murdering people with his own hands, which I doubt congressmen often do. They probably outsource it.
Well, even if you don't go to the extremes of the things that he does, like setting up the congressman, you know, he bails him out of jail for the drunk driving, then kind of controls him, gets him sober, and then sets him up with the prostitute to make him relapse. And it's just horrible. But even when they're in the halls of Congress, all the backroom deals, all, you know, well, I'll give you this if you, you know, you vote this way on my bill, and the way he pressures his colleagues, it just goes to show you that that's not, if you believe in democracy and the will of the people, which is absolutely ridiculous, even if you believe in that, you're putting these people in positions of authority over you, and they're not representing your best interests.
Now, we should point out that it is fiction, but I have a feeling, and I've heard anecdotal evidence from people who've been Beltway insiders, that this show is just dead on accurate in how things work.
Yeah, I could totally see that. It's you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours, and there's no real concern. And
if you don't scratch my back, I'll stab you in the back.
Exactly. And it's not, you know, well, you don't see the moral. You very rarely see a congressman or a senator in this show that takes the moral standpoint of, I have to do what's right for my people. It's always, if I don't vote this way or if I don't vote that way, I'm not going to get reelected. It's all about their own personal power and glory.
Actually, the president in this show kind of seems like he still believes in the system, but he's also totally a pawn of several people around him.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm starting to see how he's getting played by, oh, what's the old guy's name? His confidant.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
I can't remember. Yeah. He's a businessman.
Billionaire industrialist basically owns the president and is trying to own Frank Underwood and not doing a very good job, and that's a lot of the drama in season two, the conflict that leads to drama.
Yeah, well, he kind of refused him in season one, and Frank really just plays him.
Conflict is the essence of drama. That is screenwriting 101. I really feel that way in media. I try to keep my personal life as drama-free as possible. I used to be around a lot of... I never really loved drama, but back when I was drinking and doing drugs back in the day and, you know, screwing and tattooing and all that as a hobby.
Screwing and tattooing.
Yeah, as my dad would say, you're a rock man, your band, it's just screwing and tattooing. But I was around a lot of people who were kind of emotional vampires who fed on creating and being around drama. And I have gotten to a point in my life at the age 50 where I like my drama in TV.
I'm only 36 and I'm totally with you there. I've never really had to deal with a lot of that sort of drama based on the people I've associated myself with, but you do run into it a lot of times at work too. And
That's one big reason I structured my entire life for about a decade to the point where I could work for myself. And I've been doing that since 2001. And sometimes it's been pretty thin, but, you know, I've always gotten by with it, and it's gotten a lot better lately.
Well, I'm the same way. I mean, I don't work in an office. I work with individuals, and it's usually one-on-one.
What do you do?
So I work with individuals with developmental disabilities and mental illness, and it's a lot of one-on-one skill building, teaching, you know, getting them out into the community, exposing them to life.
You should turn them on to this Eliza, the computer therapist, and see if they like it.
That would be interesting.
If they don't like, you know, if they have trouble dealing with humans, it might be fun for them. I mean, I'm not saying like try to convince them there's a person on the other side of it or it has intelligence, but, you know, it might be good for a couple building exercises, you know, of just basic interaction and also of recognizing when something's messing with you, because it kind of starts to mess with you after a while.
You know, that's really interesting. I think there could be a lot of beneficial uses to that.
Although I would say from what I've heard, the Eliza computer therapist doesn't ask a lot more questions than a therapist who's making $150 an hour asks.
Yeah.
And they're similar questions.
Yeah. And apparently it just rephrases your questions a lot of times too.
Some of the time, but there's a couple, there's enough that it does that isn't that, that it really kind of fools you. We'll get back. We'll get to that later. Yeah. I want to play with this for a whole segment after House of Cards.
Yeah. But, I mean, just in closing, I think House of Cards is a good illustration of how the system works and how immoral it is. And it's great to sit there and watch it on TV and be like, yeah, this is just fiction. But it's, truth is stranger than fiction sometimes. And it kind of makes you wonder.
It's also very easy as an anarcho-capitalist to watch this show and say it's a perfect example of why there should be no government. But the people who created the show, especially the guy who created it, who's the same guy who created The Wire, I think. I've read an interview with him, and he's an adamant statist, and he's a Democrat, and he's donated money to Barack Obama. And he's the only thing he's really anti that makes sense is he's incredibly strongly against the war on drugs. But that might just be a personal thing, like, well, maybe he does drugs and he wants to be able to do them. Whereas I think, freedom is like you have to fight for the things that you don't even do, like me and the war on drugs. I don't do drugs. So,
well, it's like the old lawyer in Futurama. I may disagree with what you say, but I'll fight to the death for your right to say it.
Well, that's actually paraphrasing something.
ACLU.
Maybe it was. I don't know. I thought it was like some founding father like Nathan Hale or something.
Oh, it could go even farther back than I know. One of the big wigs of the ACLU had said that back in the 30s,
Patrick Henry said it.
Okay.
Yeah. He said, I do not agree with what you have to say, but I'll defend to the death your right to say it.
Yeah. And that's the way it should be. Freedom is not black and white. You can't apply it to one situation, but then not apply it to another. That was another big turning point for me when I was still a minarchist, and I would go into Tea Party chat rooms a lot of times, and they would talk a bit about how Obama was doing this and that, and it was so terrible, but then they would rag on people who do drugs and condone the war on drugs. And it's like, no, man, you're there's a disconnect there.
Of course there is.
And I think just to touch on that a little bit, I don't know if it's because of shows like House of Cards and because of the saturation of media out there, I'm starting to see that these cats are on both sides, not just the Tea Party, but some of the more liberal people are starting to get it a little bit more. They're personalizing it. If their issue is guns or their issue is drugs, which is a great reason to watch Guns and Weed the Road to Freedom.
Yep.
But whatever their issue is, they're starting to personalize it, and they're starting to see that violence is violence, and that's all the state does. So I think we're making progress. It's so slow,
I read an interview with the creator of House of Cards, and he basically thinks that government needs to be overhauled. That's his take on it. And I don't really remember what he thought it was. I mean, there's a couple things that Frank Underwood says in House of Cards that, kind of implies something to the effect of like, oh, democracy is such a hassle. It gets in the way of me doing what needs to be done.
Yeah.
It sounds like, and he is the hero. He's the anti-hero, but he's basically saying, I want to be the unquestioned ruler for life.
Well, I was very surprised that he took the vice presidency. I didn't see that coming, because to me, he had more power and influence in Congress.
You don't see why he did that?
I do.
It's a stepping stone to being president.
Right. But again, to me, it still seems like you would have more power being in Congress than the presidency. I guess, I don't know, maybe not. But
that's historically been true until Cheney. Cheney granted the vice presidency a bunch of rights and powers and tyrannical powers that vice presidents had never had before.
Yeah.
Before that, vice presidents were historically a spare tire in case the president blows out, and were a tiebreaker in the Senate, and mainly just cut ribbons and flew around the world at stuff the president didn't want to bother doing.
Exactly.
Go to funerals, you know, things like that.
Well, one of the things that Frank, it's a theme throughout the show, and he actually said it one day when he was talking to the audience, is he was talking about how the billionaire industrialist thinks he's so great because he has all this money, but he doesn't understand the difference between money
and power. And
wielding power.
Yeah.
And so that's
I don't think he's talking about him in that case. I think he's talking about people who are millionaires, not billionaires. I think he was talking about somebody a little lower than that guy, because that guy has pretty much unlimited power over the United States federal government, too.
Well, yeah, because he has connections, though. That's a big part of it. So
we'll be back with more. Hey, have you seen, did you know that the American House of Cards is based on a BBC English?
Yes, and I'm going to check that out.
You should watch that when you're done with the American one, for sure.
Yeah, definitely.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends. So much truth, it hurts.
This is the Central Scrutinizer. I steal your labor by force through taxation.
My job is to spy on you and keep you from hearing things like the Freedom Fiends. I especially do not want you to torrent
Freedom Fiends episodes to keep them drone-proof. Do not go to freedomfiends.com and click on the torrent link and learn how to torrent Fiends archives. Do not go to freedomfiends.com and click on the torrent link and learn how to torrent Fiends archives. Do not go to freedomfiends.com and click on the torrent link and learn how to torrent Fiends archives.
Michael Dean, Freedom Fiend. We're going to try to pass the Turing test here. There's a thing called ELIZA. It's a computer program. It's made in the 70s. It was for it was on mainframe computers. Between 64 and 66. there's an emulator for it using the same, I don't know if code, but same interactions. For a web-based one, if you go to, I'll post this in the link. If you're playing at home on the home version, you can go to the Wikipedia page on ELIZA computer program, and there's a few links at the bottom. It's not the first one that goes to a Facebook plugin. God, why in the world would you want to go on Facebook and be psychoanalyzed? Yeah. You know, you might as well just like upload your thoughts and dreams and hopes and prayers to the NSA.
Well, aren't you being psychoanalyzed anyway every minute you're on Facebook?
Yes, by people who are slapping you in the face with red herrings. All right, so we're on this thing called ELIZA, and it's just a little text chat interface. Now, here's the thing. Let me read a little bit about this. It blew people's minds when it came out in 64, because this was like 15 years before there was really any interactive computing or home computers or networking among the average person, and there were a lot of people who believed this thing was really had a person on the other end of it. Although if you go on it long enough, it really doesn't take long to figure out to fail the Turing test, but it can pass it for four or five back and forth. So it starts with a prompt that says, "Hello, I am ELIZA," and you went to the page, but you didn't type anything in, and after a while, what did it type to you?
Oh, no, I had typed a couple of things in, and then we went to, we finished the segment talking about House of Cards, and I had left it idle. And it said, "Are we going to chat? I can't help you without a dialogue."
Are we going to play a game? Yeah, okay. So let's both type the same thing and see if it comes up with something else. Okay. What do you want to type?
I don't know, man. You go first.
My cat is sad. And it said, "Don't you ever?" Mine said, "Don't you ever say hello?" So I'll say, "Hello, my cat is sad." Yours said, "Tell me more." Yeah. Mine says, "How are you today? What would you like to discuss?" It already failed the Turing test because it's trying to be really formal, and it's like, "No, I have needs. My cat is sad."
Yeah, I typed, "My cat is sad today," and it said, "Can you elaborate on that?"
Mine said, "Tell me more." I think my cat is planning to kill me.
Okay.
Do you really think so? What did Drew say?
I'm a slow typer.
I'll say yes.
Yeah, same thing. Do you really think
and
so?
And it said, I understand. And I'll say, do you really?
Oh, mine said, are you sure?
Mine said, you're not really talking about me, are you? It's a paranoid therapist.
Yeah, it is.
Are you paranoid?
Okay, so mine said, are you sure? I said, I am. It said, how long have you been?
I said, are you paranoid? And it said, would you prefer if I were not paranoid? I said, yes. And it says, I see. And I'll say, do you really? Really, though?
Yeah, this one is, yeah. It said, how long have you been? When I said, I'm sure. I said, 6 years. And it said, okay, I think your cat is planning to kill me. Tell me more.
And I said, I'm happy. And it said, did you come to me because you are happy? Yes. It's going to say, tell me more. I know it. I understand.
I typed, I'm happy. And it said, how long have you been happy?
Ah. So it's not the same answer every time. That's kind of interesting.
Yeah. I told him, how long? Tell me more.
I want to say, how much do you get paid? That's something you'd want to ask a therapist, especially if you're paying them. It says, we are discussing me. We are discussing you, not me.
Yeah, I got the same answer. I'll say, if they had one that was a little more advanced, this could be a lot of fun.
There is the text for it, the code, and it says, if you don't like it, here's the code, make it better.
Yep.
Yeah. It would probably just be a matter, you probably wouldn't have to know programming. You could probably just add to the list of possible answers. Sort of like with my Bitcoin BS generator. Have you seen that?
Yeah, I've been meaning to check that out.
Check it out now.
I will.
We'll be back with Hour 2 with Freedom Fiends with Chandler St. Pierre. The, what are you, the laughing coon cat? No, the jabbering coon cat.
I don't know. I kind of like the laughing coon cat.
Yeah, there's already a laughing kitty. You can't have a laughing kitty.
All right.
The anarchist tyrant has decided.
You've read books, attended lectures, and you know the Constitution well enough to know it's a well-crafted blueprint to create an ever-increasing federal empire. But there's still one thing missing.
Buttons!
Freedom Fiends now has buttons. You'll get state speech is hate speech, guns and weed, buy sheep for sheep on sheep, and two designs for the Freedom Fiends. Wear them with pride. Use them to start conversations with statists.
It's only $10 for 10 buttons, including shipping.
Go to freedomfiends.com and click on the link at the top that says Buttons.
Hey, this is Squisklar Squiggles from Death Clocks. And you are listening to the Freedom Fiends on the, you know, the radios. And I guess I says worms now. So there you go.
What does freedom mean? Tune in to LRN.FM to find out. LRN.FM is the Liberty Radio Network. A collection of live talk radio and podcasts, all coming from a principled pro-liberty perspective. LRN.FM show hosts aren't left, right, or conspiracy kooks. You can tune in 24/7 to LRN.FM via your phone, computer, satellite, and more. Listen free anytime at LRN.FM. That's LRN.FM.
The Freedom Fiends. This is 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 the Freedom Fiends. That was an exercise that they taught me in English class in like fifth grade to show emphasis, and it really resonated with me. Which is, I put a lot of importance in the emphasis of individual words in a sentence. And if you read the books I've written, there's a lot of italicizing of single words in a sentence. What were you going to say, brother?
I was just going to ask, is this the Freedom Fiends after dark?
It's the nighttime Freedom Fiends. The Freedom Fiends is now 7 days a week. The proper name of both shows, it's all one show. It's called the Freedom Fiends, but... It is after dark, and it's the Freedom Fiends. There was some little interim blurp or bubble called Michael Dean After Dark. And I had a bunch of buttons made, and I've still got them. I'm going to give those away at Porkfest for anyone who hangs out with me after dark, because Michael Dean After Dark is no longer a radio show. It is a state of mind. So if you are hanging out with Michael Dean After Dark, you get a button that says Michael Dean After Dark.
Well, can't wait. I'm so excited for Porkfest, too. It's going to be great this year.
Me, too. I've never been. I'm very excited.
Yeah, my kid's bringing one of her friends, and they're both really excited. And I guess they got a lot of younger adult stuff, activities planned this year.
Like your own AR-15?
Yeah. Well, there was a guy last year that built custom guns. I have a picture of one of the AKs that he built, all from, he called it his Frankenstein gun. It was all from spare parts, and it was so amazing. It's like $3,000, but I sat and talked with him for a while. He's a really cool cat.
Yeah, I'm not going to go to any of those. I'm not going to go to the shooting either. I'm going to be packing, but I'm not going to go shooting. Because I don't want to leave Porkfest. I don't want to go out in the sticks somewhere. I want to be around all my friends. Because, you know, you can't really talk when you're shooting.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm a talker, man. I can't stop talking. And I want to listen because I want to meet people. I want to meet all my imaginary friends from the internet.
You're not staying on site, though, right?
Nope, I'm not.
Yeah.
No. I was going to say, hell no. But I would qualify that by saying I'm not saying it's bad to stay on site. I'm just saying I prefer the comforts of a nice place.
Yeah.
Which isn't to say I'm soft and would be eaten by zombies in the first wave of the zombie attacks. But, yeah, you know, I don't know. I'm a grown-up. I'm not saying it's immature to camp. I'm just saying I don't want to camp at this point, at this time, at this juncture.
There's something fun about it. I mean, I still have to have my air mattress so I can get my 6 hours, 4 hours, whatever it's going to be of sleep.
The main reason I'm not going to camp is because I won't get enough sleep because I'm going to be doing the nighttime show there. And if I'm finishing a show at 3 a.m., there's no way I can ever get to sleep before 4 a.m. when I do this show. Usually I edit it at home. I'm actually not going to be editing and uploading episodes. Oh, there's an announcement. All the episodes for the week will be uploaded when I get home. But, I don't want to be camping, you know, going to bed at 4:30 in the morning and then have people waking up and starting to make noise around me at 7 in the morning. I just won't get enough sleep and I'll be really cranky and won't enjoy it.
Yeah, no, that's a good point, actually. I didn't even think of that, seeing as how I'll be up a few nights at that hour. It's going to be interesting.
Yeah.
But, it's really great because I remember getting up one morning, and I tend to be an early riser anyway because I don't sleep well. And
I sleep like a baby. You know why? I sleep hard and I sleep well every night for the past bunch of years. You know why? Because I'm right. And I know it. And that just makes me sleep really well.
Well, that's good.
You know, like when they say to people who aren't right and do lots of wrong, they say, how do you sleep at night?
Yeah.
Like as if sociopaths are bothered by what they do. But no, I just know I'm right and I sleep really well because of it. And there's this thing that Hubert Selby liked to say. It was give a good day. It was like his greeting. Like instead of have a good day or have, you know, to somebody, he'd say give a good day because he felt it was less selfish. And I really like it. I really like give a good day. And I feel like at the end of most days in my life in the past bunch of years, when I go to sleep, I feel like I've given a really good day, you know, to myself and to other people. I feel like, I mean, I have this thing I've been doing for a long time, for about 20 years, where I get these calendars every year. The big like blotter business calendars, they don't have pictures of kitties or hot cars or cute girls or cute boys or guns or anything like that. There's no pictures on them. They're just big rectangles with, about two inches by 2 inches of square.
Yeah, you used to get them at the insurance agencies all the time.
Yeah, but those say have the insurance company's name on them. I get them at office supply stores. And I hang them on my wall. And before I go to bed every night, I take a black magic marker and black out the day until you can't even read the date, just solid black. And it's kind of a psychological, I wouldn't say trick, but kind of a like boost,
a ritual.
Booster shot, a ritual, yeah, that I give myself of like, yeah, I gave a good day to the point that I can just scratch it out of existence. It's gone, and I did well with it.
I like that.
Yeah. So, yeah, I give a good day, and I can't give a good day if I don't sleep enough too many nights in a row, so I am going to we're getting a hotel, my wife and I.
Yeah, well, I had thought about doing the hotel on site, but it's expensive. And
I'm not staying on site.
Yeah.
We're staying a drive. We're getting a rental car.
Yep.
Yep. We're getting a bigger rental car than we would get a lot of places. We're getting a, you know, kind of an SUV kind of thing, because if we're driving on that road at 3:30 in the morning, there's a lot of danger of hitting a moose, and a moose will kill you if you hit it going at any speed in a car. They're so big.
Oh yeah. They are.
Yeah. And they got those in Wyoming, but not around where we live.
Yeah. We saw a deer last year. I didn't see any moose, but
there's some great footage. Well, it's not great footage. It's shaky, crappy footage. It was shot early in the morning from a distance of some bears at Porkfest. Have you seen that by Dave Ridley?
Yes, I did.
Yeah.
It was great.
And I'm not saying Dave Ridley's a bad videographer. I'm saying it was 6 in the morning. He grabbed the camera really quick and, you know, it was bears.
Yep.
Kept his distance. And, you know, distance with video amplifies hand movements or vibrations. Like, the further away you are from what you're filming, the more the tiniest little vibration is going to be apparent. Yeah.
Digital zoom.
Yep. Or even if you don't, even if you're using a, you know, old fashioned Super 8 film camera, it's just it's a fact of optics. It's kind of, I think it would be applicable to minutes of angle, which, any of these people that are talking about taking over the world in a revolution, if you don't know what minutes of angle are, you're not the person to do it. That's all I'll say.
Oh, you have me intrigued now. I'm going to have to check that out.
Minutes of angle is a math idea of degrees off of a line. It's basically, in the context I'm talking about, is in the context of rifle accuracy at a distance.
Right.
You know, where like if your rifle is 1 minute of angle off accurate every time, you know, that's not going to make a difference at all at 10 yards. It's going to make a bit of a difference at 100 yards, and it's going to make, you know, like a vehicle size difference at, you know, 500 yards.
Yep. Yeah, when I Googled that, first one that came up was National Shooting Sports Foundation, minutes of angle.
Yeah, but it would also be applicable. I guess I've never heard the term used with photography or videography, but I guess it would be, you know, and it's related to how, you know, a little bit of vibration is more apparent the further away the thing you're filming is.
Yeah.
So you're shooting with a camera or you're shooting with a rifle. And distance is distance amplifies how much off you are.
That makes sense.
I was gonna say logarithmically, but I'm doing the math in my head and it's not quite logarithmic, but exponentially, I think.
Yeah, because it increases as the distance goes.
Yeah.
Yep.
So where were we?
Well, I don't remember. That was like a few minutes ago.
Well, you know, the Freedom Fiends, the new motto is all tangent all the time, and the tangent is better than the topic.
Well, yeah. Well, I do know that you want to talk about Sound City. Since we discussed a book that you haven't read, now we have to discuss a movie that review, I haven't seen.
Yeah. Sound City is a really cool Dave Grohl documentary, and I think it's great that Dave Grohl is becoming a, you know, musical historian. It's a good thing for a rock star to do with their money, you know, instead of like putting it up their nose or
donating it to politicians.
Although he has sung "You're My Hero Man" or whatever to Obama at the White House, which is kind of disgusting. But this documentary Sound City, it's about a recording studio called Sound City in the San Fernando Valley outside of Los Angeles proper. I've actually played there. It's not a performance space per se, but we rented it for an afternoon to do a, you know, the main room of it, just set up like 20 chairs and invited a bunch of major label people when we were shopping for major labels with my band Bomb, and basically did a showcase there that got us signed to Warner Brothers. So I've been in the room. It's a crappy looking studio. Like, they haven't renovated. Well, it's gone now, but It was around until a few years ago, and it was just an amazing amount of records came out of there. The Nirvana Nevermind record was recorded there. All sorts of records were recorded there. A lot of, you know, like Stevie Nicks, Lindsey Buckingham, God, a lot of the hair metal hit bands, you know, Poison, stuff like that. But it's just a kind of magical studio because it's really kind of crappy. Like the room, like it's literally had, you know, like rugs. It didn't have soundproofing proper. It had like rug fragments or, you know, old dirty rugs like stapled to the wall. It was that kind of place, but had a great sound, had a great room. Drums sounded great there. And Dave Grohl made a documentary about it before it got the wrecking ball. And he also bought the board, the Neve board that was kind of the heartbeat of the place since the 70s. And those are really rare and really treasured, and they actually have a sound themselves. And they add something that you can't get without a Neve board. So yeah, check out Sound City. And then the producers of that movie just contacted me and licensed some footage from my DIY or Die movie for the next movie Dave Grohl's making, which is about 8 recording studios, including that one.
You're listening to The Freedom Fiends, and I'm beaming these words into your cerebellum.
Love the Fiends and want to help out? We do take donations and we put them back into our Liberty Projects. You can make a donation by clicking on the spinning coin on any post. But what if you want to help, but you ain't got no cash? Or you made a donation and you want to help more? Here's how you can help. Download and seed our torrents to help keep us drone-proof. There's a Torrent Club link at the top of freedomfiends.com. You can also blog the Fiends and share episode links on Facebook, Twitter, and elsewhere. You can rate and review our movies on Amazon and IMDb. You can rate and review the Freedom Fiends and our songs on iTunes. That really helps a lot. You can buy our movies and share them with friends or give them out as gifts. And one of the best ways to spread liberty is to buy a bunch of Freedom Fiends buttons and give them out as gifts. Wholesale prices are available, and you can also comment on our site, or better yet, comment about us on other sites. And please email the site link to all your friends. Thanks for helping spread the Fiends message worldwide to as many liberty people as you can, especially to those who don't yet get it. You rock.
This is Mr. Michael Dean, and I have been in at least 2 rooms that Charles Manson has been in. I just realized this. Charles Manson recorded at Sound City. I've also sat in a chair in a room, in the same chair that Manson used to sit in, because I used to date a woman in San Francisco whose father had been Manson's parole officer before the murders. And he'd been to the house, and he was like, yep, he sat in that chair you're sitting in right there. And it was – come to think of it, I never thought about this. The dad, the first time he met me, like, brought me in the house, like, hey, good to meet you. And, like, you know, and they kind of gave me the, like, what are your intentions with my daughter talk. And he told me which chair to sit in. He, like, pulled the chair out and had me sit in it. Now, I'm thinking about that now. I've never realized this. He had me sit in the Manson chair.
Yeah, subtle message.
Maybe it was the guest chair, but, you know, speaking of what?
Well, did you hear that Manson's getting paroled?
No. Is he?
Yes. Yeah, his parole was approved.
It about was in time.
The news last week. Yeah, he's 79.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people said that he would get murdered if he ever got out, but I don't know, man. People have forgotten about that. And where's he going to go work? Is he going to go, like, live at Trent Reznor's house or something?
Yeah.
Probably. So let's see. Other people.
No, he's going to live at Marilyn Manson's house.
Marilyn Manson's house. I don't know. I don't think Manson would make a good roommate. I think he's too nutty. Even aside from the murders, the interviews I've seen with him are kind of, although, you know, he sounded, I thought he made, Geraldo look crazy. I thought Manson sounded sane compared to Geraldo, but Geraldo's a douche. So let's see, other bands that recorded at Sound City: Neil Young, Dr. John, Crazy Horse, it's Neil Young's band, Leon Russell, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, Red Hot Chili Peppers, Rick Springfield, Ronnie James Dio, Foreigner, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, Nirvana, Rick Rubin, Johnny Cash, Metallica, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, here's the thing. I've recorded in I never recorded at Sound City, but like I said, I did a showcase there in the main room. We just rented the room. I remember going there in Van Nuys. I was married in Van Nuys, by the way, at the courthouse. My wife and I got married, and we got panhandled walking out of the courthouse. Like, they were like bums going like, hey, congratulations. Hey, spare a dollar, which is just indicative of California, man. You get married, you walk out, you get panhandled.
Of course.
Yeah. So I've recorded in a bunch of studios, including Hyde Street Studio in San Francisco, which is really tony and nice, even though it's in a really, you get stabbed walking out of that studio. It's in a really bad neighborhood. It's in the Tenderloin at Hyde Street, 245 Hyde. I've also recorded at another studio where Metallica recorded, which was the Record Plant in Sausalito. And those two studios are like really cush. Like, everything looks state of the art. All the furniture looks expensive. They have like really nice, you know, all the latest video games, all that kind of stuff. And like, that's what kind of studios became after a while. It was like, you know, when the record company was riding hot, the record companies were like gods, you know, before BitTorrent came along and kind of leveled the playing field, and Napster and then BitTorrent. Recording studios were like, you know, it was like going to the Betty Ford Clinic with drugs. You know, everything was really nice, really plush, you know, refrigerators full of food that's free. Like, you're paying $300 an hour plus the engineer, plus the producer. So the food's free, because if you're in the kitchen eating the food, you're spending more money just standing there than the food costs. So they figured that out. So I've been to some really tony studios. And the Record Plant was a dump. I mean, the Sound City was a dump by comparison. I mean, it's like, I don't really remember it smelling like urine, but my memory is that it looked like it would have. But, you know, some of the greatest music comes out of really crappy studios. Same thing with the Muscle Shoals studio in, I think it's Alabama, is it? Yeah. Where Sweet Home Alabama was recorded. There's a documentary about that too. But I'm really glad that Dave Grohl is becoming a, you know, musical historian and making these documentaries. I just think it's such a good thing for someone to do with their money. You know,
it's a way to preserve that memory and to make it that place immortal in a way.
Yeah. And you know, the studio couldn't sustain, basically the internet put it out of business and home computing put it out of business, because there really aren't a lot of big name studios anymore. I mean, yeah, there are, but they're probably doing work for the government, because most musicians, you know, just build home studios. I mean, Trent Reznor generally doesn't go into a studio to record. He might go into one to master or something, but you know.
Well, I saw pictures of his studio. I actually just posted a clip of him and Alexandra Cortini from an independent documentary based on synthesizers. And we'll go back into that more, how he talks about the real feel of equipment versus virtual.
Oh, he likes tube compressors as well as all the computer fun stuff.
Oh, yes.
Is that the Manson house or the New Orleans house?
I don't think it's the New Orleans.
You're listening to The Freedom Fiends, an invigorating alternative to those other shows.
This is Michael Dean from the Freedom Fiends. I've been on the World Wide Web since its inception in 1994. I've tried dozens of web providers in that time. The only one that hasn't broken my heart is HostGator. HostGator has unlimited server space, unlimited throughput, and a guaranteed uptime of better than 99.9% for only $150 a year. You can pay a little less elsewhere, but you'll pull out your hair dealing with anyone else. HostGator has great service and unlimited tech support, only a phone call away, 24/7, 365. HostGator is where pros like the Fiends host, because we know how to do it right. Go to freedomfiends.com and click on the HostGator affiliate link on the right sidebar to sign up today.
Michael Dean, I have a correction from the last bit. I recorded at the Record Plant in Sausalito. The Hit Factory is a studio in New York where we mastered the song that was just playing from the bomb record Hate Fed Love. It was recorded at Laswell's Greenpoint Studios in Greenpoint, Brooklyn, and mastered at the Hit Factory. I wasn't there for the mastering. I like was in the middle of quitting my band for the fourth or fifth time. I was like, you know, you guys mop it up. You guys master it. I'm out of here. So, or they mixed it and did some mastering there. So, yeah, the Hit Factory. Laswell's studio was kind of ghetto. He was in the process of building it. It's the only like expensive studio I've ever been in where there was no glass or wall separating the recording desk from the band. We were all in the same big room. It's kind of weird.
My first introduction to Bill Laswell was working with some sound packs on Reason.
I use those sound packs. Yeah, he has them for Acid too.
Yep.
Yeah, those were recorded around the time we were there, early 90s. I think one of them is Nicky Skopelitis playing guitar. And I always thought Skopelitis sounds like a skin disease, but he's the session cat that Laswell used on everything. And Skopelitis was like sitting in the waiting room of that studio, like every time we were in there, like noodling on his guitar with no amp, just, you know, on the strings, on the electric guitar, waiting for us to finish so he could like slurp into there and record stuff that Laswell really wanted to record rather than stuff he was just paying to be recorded to record.
Yeah. So we want to talk about writing, both literature and music.
Okay. Literature first.
Yeah.
All right. Go, Chandler St. Pierre.
No, you go. You're the accomplished published writer. Well, I want some tips from the master.
I make a good part of my living at writing, but not novels. It's, you know, how-to stuff. But I try to put a lot of my personality and a lot of personal stories and stuff into my tech books. I mean, $30 Film School is probably the only tech book that has, you know, software, you know, software tutorials with footnotes about shooting heroin.
Really?
That's published by and is published by the largest school textbook publishing company in the country. Yeah, somehow I got away with that, man.
That's pretty
amazing. And footnotes about, you know, being a man whore and having lots of girlfriends back in the day. I mean, that's the kind of stuff you don't generally find in like Windows for Dummies kind of books, but it's kind of that kind of book.
I like that. Injecting your personality into that.
That's injecting great. My personality and my stories about injecting heroin in girls.
Yeah, well, so I've been trying to write, and I say trying, a lot lately. For me, writing is just a way to get things out, to explore yourself, to feel better. I do like poetry and...
Ew.
I know, right? It's so pretentious.
I don't even like Bukowski's poetry. My wife does, but
I do too.
Yeah.
I really do. And I don't know. I actually wrote one, and the whole gist of it was I don't really care about I told you earlier, I wrote one making fun of my writing.
Ooh, that's so meta.
Yeah, well, because it like is.
Gen X-y, man.
Well, you can't take yourself too seriously. I mean, I read a lot of like poetry and books in general, and a lot of these guys take themselves so seriously.
Writing is so square.
Yeah, well,
I don't do it anymore. I don't like it. I did a whole episode called "Writing is So Square," and I'm not denigrating anyone who writes and thinks it's important that they write. And there's good stuff that's important still being written, but I really just like the immediacy of talking more, of spoken audio. You know, I guess this is my nightly poetry slam, and I do realize that this isn't for everybody, and some people are kind of like, ugh, this is boring. But, you know, a lot of people love this, and a lot of people – I just got an email tonight. I want to read this email. Someone just wrote someone named Travis, not the Travis that usually writes us. It's a different Travis, said, Michael, thank you for your badass show. I'm addicted. Worms, Travis. I like that.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Well, I
guess say one little thing, though. Some of this just sounds like two buddies babbling and, you know, having a conversation and doesn't sound like it's done for radio. And it's not. It's just two buddies babbling, me and a different buddy every night, rotating 11 different buddies. The thing is, like, once or twice a week, I say something in passing that is of utmost importance, and the real fiends know it and know how to pick out and use their secret decoder rings. So, you know, this is all kind of like, it's kind of like on,
wait, we got rings.
Yeah. Oh, you didn't get the ring?
Okay. No, not yet.
It's kind of like in that B movie that David Bowie's in called Man Who Fell to Earth. You know, at some point he makes a record and, you know, gets it played on radio, and it's not very good music, which is kind of ironic because it's Bowie and he's great. And it's in the native tongue of the planet he's from. And most people just think, oh, that's weird. And the music isn't the message. It's like the words, there's actually secret messages in his language that no one can speak that are like telling his wife how he's doing. And about once or twice a week, I say 10 or 20 words strung together on here that are more important than most things most people are doing, but the fiends know what they are and have to figure them out if they don't.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think there's importance in both talking and writing. I love to, you know, come on here and talk with you, and we do our podcast every once in a while. And it's just a different type of medium and different type of expression. But I do like what Bill Buppert said on your cast one time, that writing is totally different because you have to organize your thoughts and get them out, you know, put them down on paper or whatever, your computer screen. And you really have to think, and you can rework it and rework it. And for me, that's what it is. Like, I'll carry a notebook around during the day and just write random thoughts. It's like I'm not writing a story or writing poetry. I'm just making observations. And then later on when I record them on my computer or whatever, I'll start by typing exactly what I wrote, and then I'll go through it and kind of change it or whatever. And it gets me thinking. And that's what I like. It's an exploration and kind of a release.
Well, writing is there's a guy named Steve Elliott in my DIY or Die movie, who's a professional writer. And he, one of the things he says in the movie that I really like, I'm paraphrasing, but it's something like, writing is great for people who want to be alone and have an audience at the same time.
And that's so true.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, part of the being alone, I mean, part of the importance of writing is what you mentioned of editing and rewriting. And the thing is, you know, I always used to see people writing screenplays in LA in coffee shops. Like, there's coffee shops that have 25 people working on a screenplay in them. It's not uncommon, but I'd peer over their shoulders a little bit, and I don't think I ever saw anyone rewriting, which is why the reason those people were never, you know, never sold their stuff, because they think that writing, there's this kind of like beatnik thing. I call it the beatnik lie, that the first draft is the only true draft of any art form, and everything after that is making it less pure. I think that is just utter horse crap. I think it's totally untrue. And I think a lot of the craft of writing comes in the repolishing of it. Whereas I kind of feel like live radio is really true in a way that the published written word isn't, because it's so immediate, because it's coming out of my mouth right now. I mean, because it's going up on satellite and out to radio. Like, if you're listening at home on the radio stations we're on, you're hearing it about a second after I say it. And if you're listening streaming on LRN or GCN, you're hearing it about 30 seconds after we say it, 15 to 30 seconds, depending on the buffering. But it's still really, really immediate. You know, it's so different than writing. I'm kind of loving it as an experiment.
It's like, raw.
It is raw. And going to six nights a week, seven shows a week, six live, it's sometimes I'm overwhelmed and I'm like, how can I keep this up for years? And I'm like, I'm going to do it as long as I can. I'm going to do it until they throw me in prison or shoot me in the head, because it's a grand experiment to me. And it's kind of like what I always wanted to do. And, you know, ever since I was a kid, like, even when I was writing books and writing music, like, I didn't carry around a pencil and paper. I carried around a little dictaphone cassette player, which is one of the reasons, the things I love about Death Clock is Nathan Explosion has one of those too. It's probably digital, but he's always like, idea for song, skinned alive, forever. You know, like, he just like mumbles these absurd things into it. But I wrote my first novel partly with a dictaphone and then transcribed it and started rewriting it. I mean, that's kind of, to me,
well,
and one of the compliments I get a lot about my writing is that I write the way people speak. And it's because in my head, like, writing is just transcribing and perfecting one person speaking to another.
Yeah, I can see that. And just think about the beauty of technology now. We all have that dictaphone in our pockets. with your smartphone. You can just hit your record button and take notes. I've actually done that before. And to me, there's something about taking the time to write it down on a notepad. I like that. But when I started doing this, that's what I would do. Just hit the record button.
I can barely write with a pen anymore because I've been typing so much for so long. I think I was typing during a break and you said, like, man, you type fast, didn't you?
Yeah.
Yeah. I
mean, yeah, when we were doing the Eliza thing. Yeah.
Yeah, I type about 130 words a minute. And it's still not fast enough. It's not fast enough for what my brain thinks. And to me, like writing was always a way to organize the kind of like machine gun rhythm that I think at into something more coherent. You know, here's the beatnik lie is that the first draft is pure. There's also something I call the Bukowski lie, which is that, you know, all you need to be an artist is like a typewriter and a bottle of booze or some dope or some heroin. And, you know, for every like Burroughs or Bukowski, there are like 10,000 drunk junkies dying in the gutter, clutching their pen, claiming to be writers. Every homeless person in San Francisco has an unfinished novel scrawled on a, you know, found notebook in his backpack. But most of them never get it to the point, you know, even people that have homes and have jobs and have resources never get it to the point where it's readable, because it's not everybody can write a complete sentence that's elegant and strong. And of those people who can, less of them can write a series of them into a paragraph that's powerful and works.
Well,
and making that into a short story or a page that works, and then a short story that works, and then a novel that works, it gets exponentially harder with each level.
Oh, I would totally agree with that. And I think a big part of that, aside from the education system in modern day society, people I've found don't read as much anymore. I love to read. And I like to read all sorts of different stuff. Poetry, you know, how-to manuals, fiction stuff, history, everything. I think people need to read more.
I read a lot, but not much long-form stuff anymore.
Yeah.
I have the internet short attention span.
Yeah, don't we all?
Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean. This is what radio sounds like now. Creamy Radio Audio. Want caviar sound on a cat food budget? Creamy Radio Audio by the Freedom Fiends has great free tips so you can sound like a pro without spending like one. The most powerful form of human communication is one person speaking to another. But if people have to suffer through your sound, they'll change the channel and miss your message. With articles on microphones, preamps, recorders, mastering, recording remotely over the internet, doing a podcast, even getting a show on actual radio, the Freedom Fiends show you what they use and where to get it. Whether you're a talk show host, voiceover artist, podcaster, evangelist, or just want to record your loved ones for the ages, at Creamy Radio Audio, the Freedom Fiends will help you make the most of your sound. Creamy Radio Audio will help you speak to the world with sound that will make people want to keep listening. Check out creamyradioaudio.com. That's creamyradioaudio.com.
Courtney Love, Daryl Hannah, and Albert Einstein all have Asperger's syndrome or had. Interesting. Interesting. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. Writing. We're talking about writing. And what do you want to talk about in this final segment, in the redemption in the third act? You know, I always do what I just did, which is like in the second to the last segment, I finish with libertarian rant number one of just like that should have been the end of the show. But I don't know. I don't time it well. So I guess I either have to explain that now or try to top it. I don't know if I'm ready to top it. Ask me questions. Okay. I'll be the Eliza bot. I'll be the Asperger's bot.
The Asperger's bot. Well, I don't know. As far as writing goes, I think whether you're trying to be published and you're an aspiring young person trying to get notoriety and fame, or whether you just like to do it for fun, which for me, that's exactly what it is. I don't care to stand on the shoulders of giants or be famous. I just want to be
kick
out
over
there.
The giants.
Yeah, I just want to peek over their shoulders, and I just want to be out there. It doesn't matter to me if people understand what I write, like it, whatever, because it's more for me. It's more to discover myself, introspection. And I mean, I think most of what I write is pretentious garbage anyway. So when somebody compliments me and says, yeah, I really like that, it's like, oh, wow, cool. But it helps you learn about yourself, and I think it helps you become a better communicator. You organize your thoughts, and you organize how you're going to communicate a message. And all of us that are into the Freedom Mission, I think that's very important, because one of our goals is to teach young people the dangers of the state and the benefits of living in a free society. But we also talk to people every day, and when we write and kind of develop those synapses in our brains, I think it just makes us better people. And we need to be more, well, okay, I don't want to be collectivist. I like to be more organized and more descriptive when I talk to people, when I try to explain to them my points of view about why I feel it's better to live in a free society and why we don't need government and, you know, all that stuff. Why we should have why I have an appreciation for art, how that enriches my life, and how it can enrich other people's lives.
Yeah. I was going to try to make a joke like, yes, brain communicate good. Yes.
Yeah.
But a lot of people can't write. I'm astonished by how poorly most people write and organize their thoughts. And, you know, something that's really common in arguing with statists is they find a typo and then play word Nazi and then dismiss everything you do based on a typo. I probably have less typos per 1,000 words than almost anybody who types on the internet. I do occasionally make them. And
why is that, Michael, though? Think about it. I mean, you do this for a living, so you practice this art every day, whether it's tech manuals or not. See, that's the thing.
I'm really good at proofreading. It's kind of innate also. I mean, to the point where when I look at a page written by myself or someone else and scan through it, the typos jump out at me as if they're underlined in red in a word processing program. I mean, they're so apparent to me. I don't catch all of them, but – and that's a hint I have for people too, is after you've done – you know, a few passes of moving things around in something you've written and improving it a bit. And I kind of read things out loud in my head, or even sometimes out loud, to see how they read and to see if they read stilted, because that's not always apparent in the first pass. I almost invariably, anything that I actually publish, you know, an article in Talkers or anything on my blog or whatever, I usually have another set of eyes go through it. And it's usually my wife, because she's really good at it. And it's part of what she does for a living as a paralegal. And but just having a second set of eyes is invaluable, especially someone who's attuned to like your own idiosyncrasies, so they don't see them as errors.
Right.
And just looks for what you need them to look for. It's been a good show, Chandler St. Pierre. I appreciate having you on.
Cool.
Chatting about art.
Art saves.
99-cent art school here on the Freedom Fiends. You can only talk about tyranny so much, man. You got to take a break and talk about life stuff. This is the radio that would be in LibPair after the government's out of the way. That's what we're going
Worms.
For. Worms. Thanks, brother man.